Okay, let me just ask you to repeat what you were saying about the importance of the sanctions and how people perceive them.
Well, as I said, sanctions are an unsophisticated tool. They harm irrespective. You cannot zero them with the due care. And inevitably, wealthy people are often able to avoid sanctions more easily than the poor. But the impression we got, and that many poor Haitians would tell the MECV in Haiti, was that they were prepared to put up with the misery of sanctions if it were to lead to the return of Haiti, and the return of Aristide, and the departure of the military.
Right.
What they were becoming anxious is that they were going to have the sanctions, and yet nothing was going to happen at the end. Now, I have to say that Caputo and myself, when we went for sanctions, I mean, we supported sanctions and we really moved in that direction. It did cross our minds that sanctions might eventually lead to a U.S. invasion. And I must confess that to some degree we felt that perhaps a U.S. invasion would not be so terribly bad. In a certain way, I think, both the armed forces and Aristide wanted a U.S. invasion. In other words, each side, I would say that the army clearly preferred Aristide to come, to return, after a U.S. invasion, when they would be protected from the wrath of the Haitian public, than if it was simply having to face Aristide on their own, if he ever came back. And Aristide felt that, although he didn't want to appear to be returning on the back of the U.S., at the same time, in order to cope with the armed forces and with the unruly elements that existed in Haiti, like the attachés and chef de section, that some kind of presence, of international presence, was required. Except he could not ask for it. He would have been impeached for saying that. So he was in a very awkward position too.
Okay. Now you mentioned that sanctions might lead to invasion. What's the connection there?
Because it was increasingly clear that sanctions, there would be two possibilities. One is that sanctions would probably work, but never work to the extent that the armed forces would actually depart.
Okay.
And that therefore there might be need for some kind of a now it's true that the U.S. did not always enforce sanctions at the very beginning. After the adoption of sanctions, my understanding, and again you have to check with others, is that the U.S. for example did not put enough pressure on
the Dominican Republic to
stop violations of the sanctions
over the border.
And that was, of course, very essential.
Yeah.
Also, the U.S. did not take some steps that they had said they were willing to take, and which they could have taken without even Security Council sanctions, which were to, for example, withdrawing entry permits from the key Haitian families who had children studying in the U.S., or freezing their assets.
Okay, that was not done.
That was done very late.
Very late, okay.
Very late indeed. And indeed, on a couple of occasions when Caputo and I was with him negotiating in the first half of 93, the U.S. led us to believe that if the armed forces did not play cricket with us, if they did not go along with our proposals, that they would then proceed to take this kind of action.
Okay, they were reserving that as a later threat.
At first, it's an earlier threat to the sanctions by the council, because after all, it was easier. They could do it through executive action. There was no need to go to the council
and
persuade so many other people to go along.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, for reasons that you can only imagine, those sanctions actually were implemented much later than the Security Council sanctions.
Right, right. Is it your opinion if they had actually
been implemented earlier,
would that have made a difference?
I think if they had been implemented earlier, and all the signals that went to the Haitian military from the U.S. side had been in one direction,
Okay.
Then yes. If there had been mixed signals, as that kept being either from the Pentagon or perhaps from the CIA or from some elements in the State Department, then mm-hmm. of course, then the I don't know exactly how it would have played.
Because as you were saying earlier, often people don't understand that the American government is not monolithic.
Correct.
There's all kinds of things going on,
right.
And policies made and decisions
yeah,
made.
Exactly.
And it isn't always consistent.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Let's see. The conference that took place in Miami in January 1994, did that play any significant role?
That's past my time.
Oh, that was past your time.
Yeah.
All right, then
unfortunately,
actually
my period in Haiti is even prior to Caputo's appointment, when I went on a mission with the Secretary General of the OAS there, and from 92 to end of July 93. That's it. That was a difference in policy, and
all right, then
we partly put friends with Caputo. We just had a different approach.
Then actually, while we're still talking, I'd like to ask you some things about Guatemala. And you were very involved in that, and did you set up
in getting the torch going, yes.
Uh-huh. So to explain to me what your involvement in Guatemala was and when you started.
Oh, I started at the very beginning. In 1990, in February 1990,
okay.
the Norwegian government why the Norwegian government?
Yeah.
I told you the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Norwegian government, the Lutheran World Federation's Secretary General was Norwegian, the former head of one of the political parties in Norway, the Center Party, mm-hmm. and he had sponsored this meeting between a group representing the Guatemalan government and the URNG, the guerrillas.
I see, okay.
And at that meeting, I saw to it, because I already knew the guerrillas, mm-hmm. that they would propose that the UN be invited as an observer at future
okay.
meetings.
I see, okay.
That's the way in the Oslo Agreement, then we were asked to be observers. Then
okay.
the Secretary General waited for the President of Guatemala in those days, Cerezo, and for the URNG to formally ask us mm-hmm. to be observers.
Now,
which
and
they
this
did
was Perez de Cuellar.
Perez de Cuellar.
Yeah, okay.
That was a month later.
I see. Okay.
And so the original role we played was of observer, mm-hmm. but soon after that, we became a kind of joint mediator with the bishop, with the chairman of the National Reconciliation Commission of Guatemala, who was the bishop of Esquipulas. And so we had this peculiar arrangement for 2 years in which there was a joint mediation between someone who was an internal Guatemalan bishop
mm-hmm.
and the UN.
That's an interesting arrangement.
With all kinds of various ramifications. And then it was thanks to the UN, presumably to myself, that we got the UN, the two parties, the government and the RNG, agreeing to a peace process
mm-hmm.
at a meeting in Mexico City in April 91. 30 April 91.
Okay.
And I continued in the negotiation up to the time when we had already agreed on the basis of a human rights agreement. Then I left in May 92,
okay.
basically following a failed meeting that the Lutherans, the Norwegian, and we had tried to arrange a secret meeting in Geneva between President Serrano and the guerrillas.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, on the one side, the bishop felt upset because he was not involved in arranging the meeting. And on the other side, the armed forces found out about the meeting. The idea was to have a meeting without the president of Guatemala until recently has been a prisoner of the armed forces. So he didn't talk to no one without the armed forces listening in.
Okay.
So the idea was to try and have a meeting completely on a tête-à-tête basis. Uh-huh. Anyway, that failure led to the fact that the military questioned my views, my position, and then I left.
And so then it was no longer possible.
I did it until, yeah.
But there was a group of then, friends, so it was Norway.
No, up to then, there were no friends.
No friends, okay, so.
Then in May 92, after the position of the government was not so much to challenge me per se, but to say that I had exceeded my role, since after all the UN role was not entirely that of being the mediator. So the Secretary General decided to downgrade the level of the UN representation, and he sent a more junior person, who is Jean Arnault, who is now, of course, the moderator. And then for a period,
did you say his name again? I don't know.
Jean Arnault.
Arnault.
Whom you must talk to for the process after I left. Basically, he took over, kept a low profile, the negotiations broke down, and then only they were properly resumed, I think, at the beginning of 94. And at that time, the UN then became the official mediator, and this arrangement with the bishop was lapsed.
I see. Okay. Is that group still in existence?
So the friends of the friends of the Secretary General come up at that by then.
Okay. Okay.
In my time, the negotiations in Guatemala were always seen as secondary to the ones in El Salvador. So there was not a great deal of interest on Guatemala at the time.
See, okay.
The U.S.
Was it just 'cause of overload?
The U.S. felt it had little influence. On Guatemala, it was more concerned on El Salvador. Mm-hmm. There were two countries. There were three countries I involved myself, which I felt would be useful. One was Mexico, because of course it was Mexico. Mm-hmm. One was Spain, because they had a very good ambassador in Guatemala City.
Oh, okay.
And anyway, they were anxious to help.
Yeah.
And then Sweden stroked Norway. Sweden, because it had a very good man in, at that time, the Norwegians had no embassy except in Costa Rica, in the whole of Central America.
I see.
And the Swedes had a very good representation in Guatemala City.
In Guatemala City. Okay.
So they were involved in terms of helping.
I see.
And in fact, they organized for us. I asked them to do on Guatemala what they had done for us in El Salvador, namely organize a meeting of experts on how the UN could help establish a verification mechanism on human rights in Guatemala and also on indigenous populations.
Mm, right.
So we organized this meeting in Sweden in June 1991 in a place called Sigtuna. Again, the problem became, should we, about the role of the bishop. The bishop, who had a very large ego, felt slighted that he was not, that this meeting was to advise the UN rather than him. So he boycotted the meeting, and at that time the military...
But he was invited.
He was invited.
Uh-huh.
And the military learned about it and decided to use that against the UN. Mm. So they continuously accused the UN of having organized a meeting in Sweden to assist the URNG in the negotiations, when it was, of course, to assist us in the negotiations. So it became, I mean, Guatemala is a much more difficult case than El Salvador. Mm. And the role of the armed forces at that time was a very negative role. Now things have changed a great deal in Guatemala in the last few months. So that's basically and Norway was a little bit involved because of the Lutheran World Federation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then increasingly Norway became involved. As for the establishment of the Rule of Friends takes place in a different way. It takes place really in 1993, when there was a meeting, I think, of the presidents of Mexico, El Salvador, Venezuela, and Colombia. In Venezuela, at which President Serrano was invited. Mm-hmm. He went there and he proposed there and then the establishment of a group of friends of the president of Guatemala. So originally they were established as a group of friends of the president of Guatemala. Well, when it became, when the and they added Spain, because Spain had already been a member.
Right.
And Spain had to point out that this was not, was a very unusual group of friends. That was a friend of one of the parties.
Mm-hmm.
And then is when things were changed into becoming a group of friends of the process. Not of the Secretary General, of the process.
I see.
And the U.S. then was added.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm not sure how, but Norway was also added.
Uh-huh.
Basically, because the perception of the URNG was that the group of friends was too much on sympathetic to the government. And by adding Norway, they felt that they would have a more balanced group of friends.
Okay. Oh, that's very interesting. Are you rushed?
I have the Portuguese ambassador waiting outside.
Oh, you have the Portuguese ambassador.
Right.
Okay.
How many more questions do you have?
Well, only that I wanted to just ask you on the human rights agreement in Guatemala. What role you played in bringing that about, and did it have some of the similar parts of the agreement that the El Salvador did with the Truth Commission and certification?
Yes, I would need to discuss that, but
another time.
Unless you want to wait until 5:15, but now I can't make him wait because he has been.
That's right.
He has a very tight schedule.
Okay. Now we were just wanting to finish up by talking about your involvement in the human rights agreement in Guatemala, and I was asking you somewhat what was contained in those agreements, and whether they were somewhat similar to the El Salvador.
Well, if you look, it's quite easy for you to see what was agreed, because the agreement on human rights that was signed, in 94, I think. Now getting my ears confused.
Yeah, I can check it.
Either 94 or early 95 on human rights is very much the agreement that we had already negotiated as early as late 91, early 92.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And if you look at the agreement, there are a lot of parallelisms with the San Jose agreement.
Okay.
Of El Salvador.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Of course, there are some differences.
Yeah.
And I gather there are some other differences added since I left. But on the whole, it was very similar to the San Jose Agreement.
Okay.
Changing a little bit the wording and so on to avoid offending Guatemalan susceptibilities. The Guatemalan government, I should say, felt all along that. At least, the Guatemalan authorities, meaning the president and the armed forces, felt that they didn't want to suffer the fate, as they saw it, of their Salvadorian counterparts, where they had felt the army had been reduced, had been purified, had been removed from a role in civil society, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we had always to be careful not to appear to be copying the Salvadorian process.
Okay.
And the URNG for its side also felt that the FMLN had gone too far.
Mm.
So in concessions.
Mm.
As it turned out, of course, we all knew that eventually they would follow a similar path if they were to reach an agreement at all. But anyway, so the agreement is relatively similar. When it came to the Truth Commission, the Truth Commission, I should remind you, in El Salvador was not agreed at the time of San Jose. It was agreed much later. But in the case of Guatemala, the URNG immediately put as a major issue for agreement a commission to look at the abuses committed in the 30 years of war. Now, the Guatemalan military was very opposed to the idea of a Truth Commission. First, didn't want the name, of course, because it was the same in El Salvador's, but particularly it feared, to some degree rightly, that the truth, a commission to investigate the past would be used to really completely deprive the military of any legitimacy, because the abuses committed in Guatemala during the 30 Years' War are far worse than the ones in El Salvador. And some of the most incredible horror stories happened at the time. So why, however, why was it possible to have the idea of a commission on the past introduced? I suggested a different name, commission on the past, to avoid the word truth commission.
Okay.
And I felt that the truth, that we were able to get the truth commission because the President Serrano, you know, is a Protestant, is a Protestant.
Okay.
An evangelical Protestant. And as a good evangelical Protestant, he has a much greater feeling of guilt and of the need for reconciliation, guilt, than a Catholic would. And so he, for on that issue, despite the fact that his military was so against it, he accepted the principle. Once he accepted the principle, then it was a question of finessing, how it was going to be done. And the main difference, and I think it's an unfortunate departure from what I would have liked to have seen, is there is only going to be one foreign member of the Truth Commission, whereas in the case of El Salvador, the three were international. My feeling is that mixed commissions or internal truth commissions don't work so well. The one in Haiti has not worked very well. This was a mixed commission. It's very difficult. I can't think of any Guatemalan who is entirely impartial about what happened during those horrible 30 years. It's still a major step forward. And since it has the experience of El Salvador beforehand, I think it should be able to go beyond what the Truth Commission in El Salvador did. The situation in Guatemala is evolving favorably. The armed forces are changing, both because they have been purified already to some degree, and also because they themselves realize that they can't continue behaving as they did 30 years ago. Minurua has done a very good job. The praise of Minurua is rather universal.
Now, is there also a component of verification of ongoing practice?
There is now, yes. Now what we have, as a result of the human rights, what was agreed already in 1991, 1992 was that although all the agreements would come into force at the same time, that is, nothing was agreed until everything was agreed.
Okay.
In the case of human rights and of the human rights verification mission, this could begin upon signature of that particular agreement.
Okay, now we're still talking about Guatemala.
Human rights, yeah,
Guatemala. Okay.
And so in Guatemala, as soon as the human rights agreement was signed, which was only in 94, or early 95, now I'm confused, 94, Minurua was established. This is the verification team, which was able to draw on personnel that we had already used in El Salvador and Haiti, where of course we also had a human rights mission.
That's right.
Established at the same time that the negotiations began.
Right.
So now people didn't believe in 1990-91 that it would be possible for the UN to establish a verification mechanism in situ on human rights in a country like Guatemala. I must confess that I was almost afraid myself of it, although that is, how will the military and the death squads of Guatemala allow a UN mission to poke its nose around the country as to what is happening, what is happening? Well, it's work.
Why is it working?
I'm not entirely sure. I believe that a lot of these peace processes, internal peace processes, have a dynamic of their own. The fact that two parties sit down and agree to start talking does not mean that they want an agreement of the kind they will eventually sign. I am sure that neither the FMLN nor the government of El Salvador thought in 1989 they would end up signing what they signed in 1991.
Yeah.
The same happened in a way in Guatemala. The peace process has had its own dynamic. and has led to changes within Guatemalan society. And as you know, there's been several palace coups in Guatemala in the last, and all of that has led to a change in mentality.
Amongst the people?
The people was not so important, because the people, I mean, it was amongst the elite.
Elites, okay.
And particularly amongst the armed forces and a lot of the urban elite.
No, it changes in terms of that they want to get on with their lives and have peace, or changes in a sort of moral sense?
Well, I think both. I think mainly they want to, they see other societies evolving, and they see that nothing, after all, despite all their fears about El Salvador, they realize now that in El Salvador, the business community is profiting from peace, that the coffee growers are profiting, so they are beginning to feel that perhaps in Guatemala they don't have to fear that allowing greater participation by the indigenous people, for example, or cutting the size of the army, or preventing them from committing atrocities, is going to lead to a major change in their daily lives. I think the end of the Cold War has helped, of course. Exposure to the outside world has helped. And of course, it was very important what happened in this country in the last 2 years with Jennifer, now I know her, the wife of the Guatemalan guerrilla, the widow of the Guatemalan guerrilla, who made this campaign. Because there has been enormous publicity in this country about Guatemala, in particularly 1994, and about the role of the CIA in Guatemala, which has stiffened, I think, those forces in the U.S. that want to help civilize and civilianize both Guatemala. And I think that has also been helpful.
Yeah.
I would say that that has been.
And the issue of the torture of the American nun, the woman that was.
And the issue of the torture of the American nun, and the killing of this of the innkeeper, Michael Devine, in 1990 in the Petén.
Is there another component to this where? Another step in the area of human rights is to prevent impunity, in other words, to have this now built into the justice system.
Well, clearly, for the future, you have to build into the justice system. I mean, if you're going to reform a society, you need to establish solid national institutions. The Guatemalan negotiations have not yet reached the issue of the judiciary.
Okay.
They will need to reform the judiciary, as has been done also in El Salvador. If you're going to have national mechanisms to prevent abuses in the future, without that, you're never going to prevent it in the long run. That's why institution building is so important in these situations. At the same time, it's very difficult to say, should the issue of impunity be built in the negotiations? We had a major issue when we were negotiating on Haiti, on the issue of amnesty for those involved in the coup.
Yeah.
But the issue was not so much actually those involved in the coup, giving them amnesty for being involved in the coup, which you could claim is a political crime, but about the human rights violations that took place in Haiti during the following 2 years. And we were in a very difficult position because the army, of course, insisted on a blanket amnesty. The U.S. at that time was leaning on us to agree to a blanket amnesty. And what was worse was that because the army never quite clinched the deal, we were talking of an amnesty in the future. That is, the army more or less realized that they could continue to kill and commit human rights violations with impunity. Because at the end of the day, there was ever an agreement at all, that would be a blanket amnesty. Now, this was, you know, carte blanche for abuses.
Yeah, yeah,
now, that was completely unacceptable. On, at the same time, to say that in a negotiation, you are never going to accept amnesty for human rights violations, it's too big a thing to say to start with. It may be necessary to swallow hard and accept an amnesty for at least some violations, mm-hmm. if you're ever going to reach peace.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in if the Israelis and the PLO had not agreed, were to insist on truth commissions, and truth commissions not only to find out the facts, but to punish the guilty. Well, I think everyone would be indicted on both sides of the Middle East, mm-hmm. for example. So, basically, the important thing, in my view, is not so much getting rid of impunity. It's certainly extremely important to get rid of impunity, mm-hmm. but the important thing is to at least to be able to bring the truth to light.
Yeah.
I think people need to know what happened to their relatives. I think the country needs to go through the catharsis of knowing what happened in its recent past, mm-hmm. to learn and draw lessons and avoid repeating the same in the future.
Yeah. So then reforming the justice system would take care of future...
Reforming the justice system, reforming, of course, the entire mental approach of citizens, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Creating a culture of human rights and democracy.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
yeah.
is takes time. It needs a change in the educational system.
Just one more question, and then I think we should quit, but... In the courses that I teach at Yale, one of the questions has come up. What criteria, or how do you establish a court system or justices in a way that does, you know, protect the system? You know, if you're going to go in and the UN is going to go in and set up a justice system, you know, what kind of criteria do you use for... you know, the establishment of a court of justice or sitting judges that will actually work?
Well, I don't think we have an answer yet. Mm. I think we did something in El Salvador that went some way. We didn't do enough of it, to say the least, in Cambodia. It's also a very lengthy process to establish. So what we basically tried to do was to establish a school of magistracy, in other words, a school for judges.
A school for judges, okay.
And also to establish a procedure that would be as impartial and as apolitical as possible for the appointment of judges, mm-hmm. through the establishment of a body that would select judges for both appointment and promotion, mm-hmm. That would be either apolitical or would have it would be multi-party in its composition.
Okay.
And that's what we did in El Salvador.
Okay.
Time will only tell. Things have improved in El Salvador, no question, in terms of the administration of justice. Have they improved in a way that the clock can't be turned back? I don't know yet. We'll have to wait.
Okay. Well, I don't have any further questions. This has been really fascinating, and I appreciate your helping with this.